Okay, the date is July 18th, 2005, and this is Adam Gregg interviewing Glenn Gregg about his World War II experiences. So to start off, could you just state your first your full name and then the date and place of your birth?
Okay, Glenn Gregg. I was born right here in Hayward, in Iowa, February 8th, 1925.
And where did you live as you were growing up?
I lived here in town of Hayward, although my father was a farmer, but we lived in town. Actually, I still own the house that I lived in when I was going to high school. So I'm pretty well acclimated to this vicinity.
Okay, and where did you go to school before the war?
Before the war, why, of course, I went through elementary and high school right here in Hayward, Hayward High School. I graduated from high school in 1942, and I went for 1 year down to Iowa State College, and then went into service after that.
Okay, and did you have any time in the workforce then before the war?
No, other than when I came home on vacation, why I would go out and work on a farm. That's where all my workforce was, although on Saturdays when I was going through high school, why I worked for JCPenney right downtown on Main Street here in Hayward, and I worked after school for JCPenney and then also on Saturday night.
Okay. Now we'll start getting into a little bit heading into the war. What was your experience like in the years before the war as the country fought through the Great Depression?
It seems like I became interested in international boundaries changing very early. Even in the 39s, while we were in the Depression, in the 30s, why Russia and Finland had a war going between them, and I was really interested in that. It wasn't a big war or anything, but I look forward to reading about that. I can remember that Russia was a great big nation, and Finland was a small nation, but the Finns had cold weather to their advantage and did a lot of things to hold the Russians away, and actually ended up keeping the Russians out of Finland completely. And I think that's where I first got acclimated to war and international problems. Of course, from that time on, why then Italy invaded Ethiopia, that was also in the 30s, and I found that interesting. And again, Ethiopia fought a good guerrilla type war against a larger country like Italy. That was followed then by the Civil War in Spain. That also was in the late 30s, and I kind of followed that. And consequently, when World War II was actually declared, I had a kind of a background on my interest in reading papers about overseas, what things that are going on overseas. And there was a lot of political negotiations going on between France and England and Russia and Germany and Italy before any hostilities opened up. And that was interesting. The way it all turned out, it proved that Hitler was never going to negotiate any peace. He never had that in mind at all, but he convinced England. And the Prime Minister at that time, by the name of Chamberlain, I believe, convinced that country that, yeah, they're not going to do anything more. They might have taken over Czechoslovakia and Austria peacefully, but they won't do any more. That's all they wanted. And as it turned out, why, that wasn't the case at all. So then, while I was still a youngster, in 1939, I was just in high school. Why, September 1st, I can remember it yet, that my grandfather came into my room one morning and said, well, the Germans attacked Poland. That was September 1st, 1939. And that was, I think the history books will say that it was the real beginning of World War II. And actually, you know, I was very much involved with international policies at that time, for a kid that age anyway. And so that was very interesting to me. Little did I ever believe that that would ever affect me, but I wanted to read about it and see how the Poles could do against that big country, that big war machine that Nazi Germany had going for them. And the way it turned out, they were no match at all. The Germans did just about whatever they wanted to in Poland, and then to top it all off, Russia decided that they would also come in from the other side of Poland, and so Poland had the Russians coming from one side and the Germans from the other, and it didn't last very long at all. So that was not a war in itself, but it marked the beginning of World War II, because France and England, as I remember it, each had a pact amongst themselves, saying that if Germany ever made any aggressive moves, military aggressive moves, why that would be the same as declaring war. And they did that, and Germany and France and England took it as that, as a declaration of war, and they declared, then they went ahead and declared war on Germany and declared war and started fighting Germany. I'm sure that didn't disappoint Hitler any. He was ready to fight. I mean, he couldn't care less. He's got Poland out of the way, and now he's going to go and turn his direction to the west and go that way. Long before, I guess, listen, we're going to back up just a little. We're going to be back up into the 30s again. And some of the political ramifications of that was going on at that time was both France and Germany was building a defensive line in case war ever did come. The French was building what they called the Maginot Line, and that stretched across the border between Germany and France. In the same time, while the Germans were building what they call a Siegfried Line, that stretched from Switzerland all the way up to the North Sea. And so those two lines of fortifications will come into play later on. But right now, with war declared, why the French said, oh, we're all right. We got our Maginot Line there. They're not going to invade us. We're not sure whether we can invade them or not, but we're safe. Our homeland is safe. And but come to find out, the Germans already were planning on not going through the Maginot Line, but going around it. It was very simple. The French didn't think of building the Maginot Line so that it would stop invasions coming in from Belgium and Holland. And that's exactly where the invasions came. So when war was declared, why the German army, the Panzer Division, which indicates lightning fast, all armor and all on wheels, even the infantry were in Panzer trucks, where they came into Holland and Belgium, and again, those two small countries had very little opposition, some, but very little. And they went around into Belgium and Holland and took over those two countries, and was headed around to the end on the other side of the Maginot Line into France. England saw this right away. The English was the greatest power of the West at that time. France was the second greatest. But France was, it looked like all of a sudden, France was in trouble. The Germans were poised to come in without any defense. They're going to go around the Maginot Line. So the British right away sent what they call an expeditionary force of, I don't know how many, but several hundred thousand of their troops to stop that rush through the Low Countries, through Holland and Belgium, so that they could stop Germany from coming into France. And that's what they did. They came over there and they made a battle of it. And that's when the actual fighting started, is between what was what was left of the French. The French army was very inadequately prepared. both mentally and physically. I don't think they did much. But the English were fighters. They were ready to fight, and fight they did. But they were no match with that with that lightning fast armor division that came, the many divisions that came in from Germany through the Low Countries, and they met head on right in northwestern France, and it wasn't very long before it was evident that Germany had too much power for those two Allied countries. All this time then, America was sitting back, maintaining our isolationism. President Roosevelt was determined that we were not going to get in the war, but we were also not going to let Hitler run over any country they wanted to. So what do? We developed what we called the Lend-Lease program, where we gave as much armament and ships and guns as we could possibly give to England and France. And we sent them over there, even in our ships. And so we were helping, even though we haven't declared war, we were helping them out an awful lot. But yet, Germany came on. In 1938, President Roosevelt was reelected, and then he was reelected again in 1942. But in 1938, that's how he got elected, is his isolationism policy. He will not let us go to war. But yet we look over there and we saw the Allied forces, the German and the English forces, were actually getting beat by these German forces. And the Germans were making a circling movement around, pushing the French and the English back out towards the English Channel and back out towards England. And that's exactly what happened. It was a battle that I was always interested in and never got a book to read about, but that had to be an awful interesting part of the war, is when the English took it upon themselves to evacuate those 100,000 men and get them out of there before they were captured by the Germans. That's what it amounted to. They were getting beat that bad. Germany had control of the air, and they were bombing and strafing, and the English got the very big majority of all those troops out of France at that time, and over to the English Channel back home. That was called the Battle of the Dunkirk, and that was a very interesting battle. And it didn't last very long, but it was very decisive. And the Germans just completely kicked all the Allied forces out of France completely. At that point in time, and I'm guessing at some of the dates now, it was like in 1940, because war was declared in 1939, so it was still probably a year after that, in the spring of 1940, the Germans had control of the air, not only over France, but now also over England, too. They bombed London nightly. A lot of London was destroyed. A lot of other towns were destroyed. And that went on for quite a while, and the German Air Force had control up to the point where the American airplanes that we were shipping over there for the English to fly, we weren't flying them because we weren't at war, but they were using our airplanes. They were getting so that it was more of an equal battle. And they fought back and forth, and it was hard to tell really who did have control of the air. And finally you could see that control was switching over to the Allied, or to the English side. And as we look back at it now, had Hitler in 1940, in the spring of 1940, after kicking the English and the French off of the continent and back into England, had Hitler taken that opportunity and went across those 40 miles of the English Channel and invaded England, we got to wonder what we would be doing now today here. How would our world change compared to what it is today? Could really be changed? But they didn't. He didn't, and that was a mistake. I'm sure most of the German war machine kind of realized right away. And soon, we were sending so many armaments and so many of our equipment over there. Why Hitler realized it was too late, and he instead was starting to reinforce the French and Belgian coastline, where he might expect maybe someday that the English might try an invasion of that, and to get the continent, to get back on the continent and get the French land back to the French people. All this, of course, was in 1941. That's in 1941. I was a senior in high school, and everything changed that one Sunday afternoon. America all of a sudden was not content with an isolation policy anymore, because Pearl Harbor had just been bombed, and the Japanese were carrying on and invading Bataan and killing all our young men over there. And America realized that the Japanese and the contracts and the agreement that the Japanese had with the Germans and with the Italians formed the what they call the Axis, and that we had an agreement that if any of the Axis made an effort to contact us or invade us, why, war would be declared, and we would declare war on not only just Japan but also Italy and Germany. And that's what happened. And the very next day, on December 8th, why, President Roosevelt went in front of Congress and asked Congress to declare war. And that was when he gave his famous speech that we really don't have anything to fear but fear itself. You know, and a lot of people were shocked. I don't know if we were scared, but I guess you'd call us fighting mad. Even high school seniors like me was fighting mad then, and was ready to go to war and was ready to do something. My whole senior year was involved. You know, sure, I played basketball. I was in athletics and all of that, but the war was the underlying flow of every kind of conversation there was. It wasn't what you were going to do when you got out of school. It was where you was going to go serve, where you was going to go to war. You know, I never even thought about what I was going to do when I graduated as an occupation. It never entered my mind, because I knew I was going to go to war. And all the other kids did, too. A lot of kids didn't wait until they graduated and went to war right away. And they could have stayed until they graduated from school, but they didn't even do that. So I graduated in 1942, in the spring of 42. At that time, the draft, we were drafting our 21 to 36 year olds just about as fast as we could train them. In all our factories, where everybody was going to work in factories making tanks and guns, and everybody was busy doing everything, except people under 21 didn't have anything to do. I mean, they didn't, we were too young. I went to school. I could have volunteered, but I didn't, because I thought, well, I'm going to go to school 1 year and see what happens, and maybe they'll draft, or maybe there'll be an opportunity that I see that I wanted, the area, the branch that I'd like to get in, or something like that. So I did. I went to school. In the middle of that school year, Congress passed the act of the Draft Act and changed the years that they were going to draft. The young men were lowered from 21 to 18. So immediately I was eligible for the draft. And immediately I got a draft notice from Orange City. And I was still going to school down in Ames. Well, then I got a deferment. I asked them then for a deferment. Okay, this was in March. Just give me a deferment until I finish this year out. So just a couple, 2 or 3 months. And they did. They gave me that deferment. And so I did then when I registered for the draft, and when it was my birthday in February, I registered for the draft. And then in May, when I got home from Iowa State College, I had to take my physical right away. And when I took my physical, I thought, well, geez, you know, this is my last chance to get into something besides just the Army. I didn't have anything against the Army. I wanted to fight. But the Air Force was, you know, that seemed to get all the popularity, and they made all the movies about Air Force people. And so I thought, geez, I'm going to get in the Air Force. So I went down to Des Moines. Des Moines. But I couldn't pass the test. My eyes weren't good enough. They said, well, you can be a gunner, but you won't be a pilot because your eyes aren't good enough. Well, so then I didn't do anything, and then I was drafted. So I went then in 1940. This was in 1943 now. So I went and to service in that spring with 8 other guys from Haywarden, all 18. And this was the first contingent of 18-year-olds that went from Sioux County. And we went all over to Orange City, and that's what it was. There was probably about 50 18-year-olds. And as I look at it now, I just can't imagine young kids like that all in a group, all ready to go fight someplace or other, because it seems so young. But boy, we were ready to go, and we were happy and looking forward to it. I went to Fort Leavenworth, and that's where they did some processing and determined what you were suited for in the Army. Everybody went different directions for some reason or other. I never could figure really out how the Army determined what kind of criteria they used to decide that you were ready for this particular branch, or you would make a good cook, or you would make a good mechanic. For a bunch of 18-year-olds that didn't know nothing about anything anyway, so it was hit and miss, I'm sure. But anyway, 2 of us out of that group that left for Orange City, 2 of us stayed together to the next camp that we went to.
And who was that?
That was Rich Harry. Rich Harry just passed away here a year ago. And so Rich, Harry, and I went to, in eastern Texas. We didn't know where we were going. I remember when we got on the train, why we were all gung-ho. You know, there's rumors just fly all over the place, especially with 18-year-old kids going off to war. Well, you could hear most anything. So they even thought that we were going to be shipped directly overseas without any training or anything. And that rumor got started, and we didn't, you know, and the Army wouldn't tell you where they were sending you. And it's kind of hard to tell, especially at night when you get on a troop train, where you're going. You can't tell by this. The sun would help you out, but at nighttime, you don't even know what direction you're going. And it's always kind of fun, but really, we're going someplace, but we don't know where. And we went for quite a while. Not a long time, but quite a while. I remember when we got off, when it was night again, when we got out of the plane, or got out of the train. And we could see the sky in one direction or another. We don't know whether it was east or not. But anyway, in one direction, the sky was all orange. And it's not sun, because sun, we figured out somewhere or other, sun doesn't come up that direction. It's not sun. It looked like it was on fire. It was burning. Did they take us in that short a time? Are we being invaded? Is that war? We didn't know. I never saw anything. The whole skyline lit up like that. And it was kind of scary, I guess. I don't know that we were scared that. Not, we weren't scared like we will be in a little while. But we were wondrous of that anyway. And and finally, a sergeant of the training sergeant came by and was good enough to talk a little bit to us. And so we started asking questions. We got to find out, where where are we and what is this burning in the sky? And he said, well, you're in Camp Fanta, Texas. That's east of Dallas, about 40 miles. And those are oil wells that you see off in there, and they're burning off the waste all along the horizon there. So don't worry about it. Everything's cool. And so that was that problem over there. And every night we were down there, that sky lit up like that. So that was my first experience in seeing something that we didn't really know what it was. So then we entered into basic training. Again, I forget how long that was. Either 14 or 17 weeks of intensive basic training. The sergeant says, you guys, and Rich Harry was still with me, you're here at Camp Fannin because this is a infantry replacement training center. Aha. So we finally know where we're at. We're going to be in an infantry. We're going to be in an infantry division. Well, that's all right. We have no fear. We're ready to do that. The replacement part, that we never knew exactly what that was, and I guess we never even asked at that time. But infantry replacement. If you think about it, why? Of course, that's what it is. You're going to be trained here, and you're going to be shipped overseas to replace somebody that's already been dead or wounded. They didn't tell us that at that time, but we got to know that's what it was. So all the time we're going through basic training and our trips overseas, We were never attached to our home company. We won't get to our home company or our home division until we actually reach the front line on the battlefield. That's where the 29th Infantry Division is, and that's what they're training us for. So we're going to be by ourselves. We'll just be fragmented bunch of people that's going through infantry basic training. But that's all right. We're ready. We're not. You know, we're 18-year-olds at that time with that war spirit and that the feeling of patrioticism and all of that kind of stuff. You just weren't scared of nothing. You just were ready to get in there and get at it. And our biggest fear, I guess, was that the war might end before we got to it. That was, I guess, our biggest fear. So we got into basic training. That was tough, but it wasn't tough for guys that were as young as we were and as good a shape as we were. But for guys, we see guys in our company, for instance, why we had three platoons of 18-year-olds and one platoon of 30 plus people, older guys. And what a difference between those guys really had a tough time of it. And the young kids, geez, they just went through that basic training just like nothing. It was really fun. Well, back up just a little bit. Let's back up way back to Iowa State College. When I was at Iowa State College, I took a course in ROTC. I don't know why, but it was there. And I just thought it was kind of interesting, and I had an interest in Army anyway. So I took a course in ROTC. That course got me so that I knew a little bit about close order drill and some of the commands that is given in close order drill. And in basic training then, our platoon sergeants saw that I had that ability where the other kids didn't, and made me a acting platoon sergeant, I guess you'd call it. I didn't get anything for it, but I was in front of the. I was in front when we marched. I think that was the biggest thing. So that then I kind of liked that. I kind of liked close order drill, and I probably made more of it than I needed to at that time. But maybe not, because when we got done with our basic training, and we were all ready to go overseas, and we were excited to do that, And they came in and pulled me out. Not Rich Harry, but just me. Pulled me out and said, we want you to stay here and go to cadre school. Go to cadre school for 4 weeks and then come back and teach new recruits, 18-year-olds that are coming in, teach them this basic training that you've just been taught. And I thought about that for a long time and visited with my folks about that. And I didn't want to do that very bad. I wanted to go with these guys, even though I knew we were never going to see those guys again. They were all going to be split up in different divisions. So I don't know. My folks, I guess, kind of decided that they would like to see me stay here, obviously. So I did. I said, okay, I'll stay here. So I went to cadre school. Well, before I went to cadre school, I had to say goodbye to all these guys these last 17 weeks that I came really close to, because these are the guys that we at least pretended like we were going to fight a war together. We were going to fight a war together, but we would be separated. But anyway, you got pretty close to those guys. You did things for and with them. And they all were excited about going overseas and boarded the buses to go down to the train depot to go to the port. And I was there by myself. That was tough. That was the first time that loneliness set in. It won't be the last time, but that's the first time that I was really lonely. There's two emotions that were very prevalent with me in my war experiences, and that is loneliness and fear. And I go from one to another, it seems like, but both of those are going to be pretty important as we go on. So but go on we did. I was lonely, I cried. Geez, you know, I didn't have a girlfriend at home I could cry to even. She went and married, wouldn't you know, an Air Force person. And so that didn't help things any either. My folks were glad that I wasn't going overseas, but they were the only ones. I was sick. So I spent the weekend or a few days there in the barracks all by myself. And then cadre school started. And they shipped me up. It was right there in the same camp and everything, the camp van. I went up to cadre school and went through this process of learning how to train people. And I kind of liked that. I got along all right. I made new friends. I was good shape again. And that didn't last very long. It was 4 weeks and you're graduated. And I went back to the same company that I left to start with. And only that night, why a whole bunch of new kids come in. And I was still 18 years old, and here I was in charge of this whole bunch of 18-year-old kids that didn't know nothing. But I knew everything, because I was been there for 13 weeks, so I knew. They thought that I was a war veteran from way back. So, but I got along all right. They liked me being the same age as they, and I knew more than they did, and it showed, and they respected that. And so I got along all right doing that. I got a promotion to corporal, and so I was getting along pretty good for a month or two, and then I was reading about the war all the time and how it was coming, and thinking that, geez, you know, they're talking more and more about the invasion of Europe and D-Day and all that kind of stuff, and here I am over here, and I mess around over here, and I'm going to miss that if I stay here. And I'd like to get out and get going in a hurry. So I volunteered for the paratroopers. And they needed paratroopers bad because of the invasions that were on all these islands and all of these places that we had invaded. They needed a lot of paratroopers, so I invaded. So I volunteered to the paratroopers. And that was a great, they liked that. They thought that was, they thought that was, they was good. That was great. It'll be a few days or maybe a week or so before you get your call and you go down to Fort Benning, I believe, in Georgia and go through paratroop school, and then you'll be ready to go because you're all ready to fight. You've had your basic training and it won't take long. Then my folks, they didn't like that idea very good. And they put a lot of pressure on me not to do that. I can see now where they're coming from too, because I don't know about my dad, but my mother, this was a traumatic experience for my mother to see me go off as green and shy young kid, go off to this war thing, and so she's really concerned about it. And I respected that enough, I guess, to go and pull out my volunteerism and tell the Army I'm going to withdraw that paratroop deal. Well, the Army doesn't look on those kind of things very, very good at all. I mean, they say, "Damn you, boy! If you're going to do this, why? Okay, but you're going to be sorry." And I wasn't sorry though, because the very next day after I said that I withdrew, they said, "You be down at the depot here, and there's a bunch of guys going up to Boston, and you're going to be on that train, and so you're going to go overseas. You got your papers to go overseas." And so that's I guess I left Camp Fannin. I left there maybe in different views. I think I did good down there and was proud of what I did, but I was sorry that I made the Army mad at me. But I was going to make it up for them, because I was still going to be a good fighting person. I was ready to fight. I went to Boston. Got to back up again one more time. Right after basic training, before even cadre school, everybody got a seven-day pass to go home, because they were all going overseas and they thought I might too. So I had a pass then. And so we're quite a ways from Camp Fannin to Hayward now. It's quite a ways. You only got 7 days or 5 days to make it. You don't fly then. You had to take a bus or take a train. But Rich Harry and I decided, let's just go out on a highway. And that we did. And we made it up there just as fast as anybody could ask for. Geez, everybody would stop and pick you up if you're a serviceman. All you had to do was don a service uniform, and you had all the respect in the world. And so that was kind of fun. We rode with different people, and they went out of their way to do things for you and take you. I know one person was going right up here at the Million Dollar Corner. Well, one person was going to Rock Valley, or to Rock Rapids, and they got to the Million Dollar Corner. I'll take you over there. 15 miles out of the way. So they took us over to Hayward, and just stuff like that. It was fun to get out on the road. And so that was just kind of an interesting part of how the rest of America looked at people in service. And they do now too, but there was a time there, and during the Korean War and especially in Vietnam War, why I think our that kind of patriotism was absent. But I think it's back now, and it's a different kind of patriotism, but the respect for the people that are serving is still there. And I'm glad to see that. So now, okay, well, we've been home on a little short furlough, and I enjoyed that, and came back and went through cadre school, and then volunteered, and then didn't volunteer, and then was shipped to Boston. And I'll never forget, we were on a troop train, always troop train. A troop train was something else. It was always slow, and it never would stop for anything, and it was dirty.
and it was, you know, it was all cold furnace. It was moved by the energy came from coal rather than diesel, so it was awful dirty. But anyway, it took us 2-3 days to get up. Oh, not 2-3 days, sure. Well, it might have. Anyway, we got to Boston, dirty and tired, and ready to get out on the open sea and get overseas. Going to Boston, why, we know that we're going to Europe rather than the Pacific. And so they, it was a embarkation point, and we got to that embarkation point, and they'd put you in barracks, and then they'd march you out of the barracks towards the dock, and with your duffel bag, or your one big bag of all your belongings, and there we were with going down the ramp, and we looked up and we saw this great big mammoth ship in this dock. It was bigger than, well, you know, us guys back there, and we've never seen a boat bigger than what was on Lake Okoboji, and so this was just enormous. Well, it turned out to be the largest luxury liner that America had, and it was named USS America, and it was converted over to a troop ship. That's what we were going to go overseas in. It sounds pretty nice going over a luxury ship. Well, it wasn't luxury by the time they turned it into a troop ship, because we had 11 people sleeping on top of one another, 11 high. It was that packed in there. It's just unbelievable. But the best part of that is that ship got over there in 5 days, I believe it was, because we didn't have to wait for a convoy. There were so many submarines out trying to, German submarines trying to sink Allied ships coming over with men and materiel, that they had to go in a convoy. Unless you were fast enough, you could outrun them, why, then you could do it. And the USS America was fast enough, so they went overseas, zigzag all the way overseas, just like that. And we had submarine drills, and God only knows what would happen if we really had a submarine torpedo us, but none did. Although, it's interesting, when we got overseas, we landed in Liverpool, and they brought one of the Red Cross workers brought a paper in, a Liverpool paper, that the German high command had issued a propaganda statement, and list some of the accomplishments that they did recently. And one of them was the sinking of the USS America coming overseas. And so it was strictly propaganda. It wasn't very actual at all. But they knew that we were out there. And they knew that the USS America made that trip and was going to make more of them, certainly. But so the Germans knew the USS America made it, and we were in England. So the next step then was, we didn't even stop and look, Liverpool, we didn't stay overnight, we boarded trains again, I think trains, maybe buses, I'm not sure, but anyway, we went across England, which is not a big country to cross, have no idea how long it took us, but I imagine a day, and we landed in a small town near Dover. But landed on the English Channel and boarded LST. Oh, yeah, one of the big wartime events happened while we were overseas, while we were on the sea. After we boarded the USS America, this big invasion started. D-Day began. And we were excited about that, but yet we were disappointed that we missed that by just a few days. We could have been there. And so we missed it, but we were keeping track of it as best we could. And so when we got to Portsmouth, or we got to this little town next to Dover, where we boarded LSTs, which is landing crafts type of ships, and went on the English Channel. And forget how long it took us to cross it, but it was awful rough. And it was long and drawn out and boring. We had a lot of equipment, and we finally got there, and we ran ashore, and the gates came down, and we saw what was left of D-Day, and it was quite amazing. It was shocking. Sometimes on pictures of D-Day, where you can see pictures of the wreckage and the trauma that was left on that beach. And there was no fighting or anything when I got there. It was, it was quiet, but you could see how it was at one time, or you could imagine how it was. All bodies were picked up by that time. It wasn't bodies floating around or laying around or anything like that, because Americans are good at that. I mean, that they don't leave bodies around very long. German bodies or American bodies.
when was this approximately?
Okay.
And we kind of lost track. Any idea where?
Yeah, we got a lost track. This was at Omaha Beach, and this was in July. No, this was June, about June 16th or the 18th or something like that. And on Omaha Beach of 1944. Yeah. And so there we were. We're still, they keep us in, understand, we're still infantry replacements. I found myself in with a group of other guys that have had infantry training, but had no unit. We weren't anything. We were just a bunch of people. How the government ever kept track of our papers, or kept track of where we were, and a lot of times they didn't. A lot of times they lost us. And you'll see later on how I moved around, and how my papers weren't ever with me. They were always about a month behind. And there were a lot of things that happened to me that I'm sure that's not on my official papers. We had papers there, and we were infantry replacements.